Coming up on a Humankind special, some young people are rethinking which foods they choose to help limit the effects of climate change.
I've always wanted to help the environment. I've wanted to do that since I was younger. And I kind of thought the only way I could make a tangible impact on the environment was through my job. So for the longest time, I've wanted to be in the environmental engineering field. But in high school, I kind of started to realize that I can do more things than just my career, because the food that we eat is a very big contributor to a lot of these effects of climate change.
In fact, about a fourth of the pollution that traps heat in our atmosphere is attributable to agriculture, forestry, and land use. And livestock production that produces burgers is a huge source of this pollution. We'll hear experts in nutrition and global warming and visit a restaurant where many customers share these concerns. I'm David Freudberg. Stay with us for the Diet Climate Connection from Humankind. Humankind is produced in association with GBH Boston and Documentary Educational Resources. This special project, the Diet Climate Connection, is supported by the Humankind Program Fund. How the foods we eat can have a major impact on the warming planet we inhabit. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. Given all the extreme weather unleashed by climate change, is it too late to limit the costs and chaos of heat-trapping gases that have accumulated in our atmosphere? Not according to Walter Willett, a physician at the Harvard School of Public Health.
Positive changes are really important because even if we can't go back to where we were 20, 30, 40 years ago, we can prevent the worst of damages by making changes today. We are going to see changes, that's almost for sure. We can't turn our dial, our thermostat down like we might be able to in our home. But the temperatures are rising. We're on track to very large degrees of climate change.
But unless steps are taken promptly to mitigate the effects, climate scientists say we're headed for devastating conditions from global warming.
Well, they're saying that because we are not just setting new records. We are obliterating, we are shattering, we are smashing these records. One climate scientist referred to this string of
temperatures in Europe, for example, above average for 11 of the past 12 months. September, that was the warmest month ever.
2023 was the hottest year on record. The European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service looked at global temperature records going back to the year 1850, and
the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States, according to the EPA, is from burning fossil fuels for electricity, heat, and transportation. But many people are not aware that our food system significantly compounds the problem. One person who's long been tuned in to the Diet Climate Connection is Frances Moore LaPay, now based in the Boston area. Her breakthrough book, Diet for a Small Planet, has sold over 2 million copies. She's been speaking out since its first publication in 1971.
I never imagined writing a book. I mean, I made a C on my first English paper in college. The only reason I took out the Olivetti typewriter and began to type is because I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to share this. This is just too amazing what's happening, what I'm learning.
Frankie, as everyone calls her, was preoccupied by a riddle and a moral question. Can our Earth, with its surging human population, produce enough food for everyone? So decades ago, she spent long hours in the library at the University of California in Berkeley, where her husband was a student.
I just thought, if I could understand why people are hungry in the world, that would give me a light on my path, because I thought, what is more important than food? And the Ag Library turned out to be run by these incredibly helpful librarians who led this 20-something around to this and that stack, and, oh, you might want to look at this, you might want to look at that. So I had this freedom to follow my nose and to just follow my heart and just ask, what do I need to know? And that seemed to me no more important question than food.
The problem, Frankie realized and documented, is that our reliance on animal products for meat and dairy takes a staggeringly heavy toll on the environment, devouring huge resources, which in turn accelerates climate change, when it's far more efficient to grow vegetables, fruits, and grains. And for Frankie, it was freeing to move away from a meat-centered diet.
Because I grew up in Texas, where the stockyards were not far away. You could smell them pretty, you know, within a few miles of my house, you could smell the stockyards. So, you know, I grew up with meat at the center of the meal, and that was just, of course, you have to have animal protein, you know, to be healthy.
She also exposed the myth that meat is a necessary source of protein. In fact, the amount of protein we need from any source has been exaggerated through extensive advertising by agribusiness. Walter Willett was longtime chair of the nutrition department at Harvard.
I think this concern about adequate protein has been overblown. In reality, it's extremely rare to see an adult in the United States suffering from protein deficiency unless they have some severe underlying illness. That basically we need about 10% of our calories from protein. Protein is essential, but we're consuming on average about 15% of calories from protein. So as adults, this is really not among the major health issues in the United States. For young children, particularly under the age of 2, getting adequate protein is important. But even there, in this country, it's rare that children are not getting enough protein. It's much more an issue in poor countries.
That means protein intake by Americans is far greater on average than our bodies actually require. And that excess comes at a high price. Here's Frances Moore LePay's daughter, Anna LePay, also an author.
There's a lot of conversation about what is the most ecological way of raising food and getting protein for the human population.
A conversation largely started by your mom.
That's right. So my book, Diet for a Hot Planet, the title, you know, is a direct link to my mother's work, Diet for a Small Planet, in which years ago she was making these arguments about how do we most efficiently and ecologically address the need for humans to eat protein. And what she was arguing in that book is that it's possible to get the protein we need to thrive from plant-based sources. We don't need to eat meat. And in fact, we can thrive without eating meat.
Since such a tiny proportion of Americans, about 2%, now work on farms, most people have only idyllic, mythical images of how our food system operates. The reality would shock many of us who contact our food not in the sunlit fields, but in the fluorescent-lit aisles of the grocery store. And the highest impact activity of agriculture today is the big business of livestock production.
Increasingly around the planet, there's this expansion of the very American-style way of raising meat, which is not the kind of traditional animal on the farm that's integrated holistically and ecologically with the cycles of the farm and producing manure that's then used for fertilizer and all those kinds of ways that animals were integrated in the farm, but instead raising animals in feedlots, raising animals in essentially factories. And as a result of this huge expansion of that way of raising animals for human consumption, what do those animals need that the animals of the more ecological farm don't need? You need to grow crops to feed those animals. They're not getting it from the farm itself. And so a lot of the expansion of large-scale agriculture into rainforests, into these vital places that are, we need for climate health, it's coming to not to feed people, but to raise crops, cereal and soy, raise crops for livestock in these factory farms.
And this occurs at a colossal scale. Industrialized agriculture is a heavy emitter of greenhouse gases that heat up our atmosphere. Globally, agriculture, forestry, and land use are responsible for about a fourth of these emissions. This includes the felling of trees, operations at the farm, including use of high-emission chemicals, energy consumed in food processing, and of course, carbon pollution from transport. Ronnie Neff studies our food system at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
There's three main greenhouse gases that have relevance when it comes to agriculture. As opposed to most of climate change discourse, we're talking about carbon dioxide. But in agriculture, we're also talking about methane and nitrous oxide.
So it's not just your carbon footprint in foods, it's other footprints you need to be concerned about.
Yeah. So when you have a hamburger, perhaps the biggest impact comes from the methane, which comes out of the cow's belching, out of the front end of a cow. And some of it also comes out of the back end of the cow. It also comes off of the manure of the cow when that manure is stored wet in kind of cesspits where they keep it. So for every cow that you produce, you've got to feed it grains in an industrial system. And so they're fertilizing it with nitrogen-based fertilizers. And so that's the chief source of the nitrogen that is coming off of the burger.
Methane and nitrogen are a red flag for climate scientists. As greenhouse gases, they are extraordinarily effective at trapping heat in our atmosphere associated with global warming, far more so even than carbon. And environmentalists are plenty worried about the carbon footprint of agriculture derived from the burning of fossil fuels.
We have fossil fuels in the machinery to produce the grains and then to drive those grains and over to the place where the animals will eat it. We have machinery where the animals are raised. We have heating, cooling, truck transportation, and all those pieces contribute, and processing as well. The processing is also dependent on fossil fuels, and all that releases a lot of carbon dioxide. And so when you get a burger, that's why it has such a big carbon footprint, because it has all those pieces involved in it.
In searching for ways to reduce the environmental consequences of how our food is produced, a new movement is emerging that takes a page from the past. Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia, New York City, 1944.
The Meatless Tuesday is working out very satisfactorily in New York City, and other cities are adopting it. People of this country must realize that we will have to be more prudent as we go along in the use of food.
Mayor LaGuardia advocated cutting back somewhat on meat consumption to assure food for troops in World War II. Today, climate activists have shifted the weekly observance to Monday, a practice endorsed by celebrities like Oprah Winfrey and Paul McCartney, who wrote a song about it.
Think of too much livestock warming up the land. Gotta think of answers. Gotta have a plan. How the world will be if we don't do something, we face calamity. Meat-free Monday, it's a fun day, and it's happening all around the world.
The concept of Meatless Monday is that by taking one day a week and not eating meat, you're actually cutting back your meat consumption by 15% right there. And that means you're cutting back your saturated fat consumption, you're improving your own health, and at the same time you're having all these environmental benefits as well.
Of course, for many people, altering our eating habits can be notoriously hard. Just ask anyone who's had trouble trying to stick to a weight loss diet. It can go up against family history, the subtle influences of advertising, and just foods we're used to.
But steps in this direction are important, and people can get experiences in plant-based eating that they never had before.
Dr. Walter Willett at the Harvard School of Public Health.
We definitely need to reduce our meat consumption by more than 1/7. It would be better perhaps if we had meat on Monday rather than only Meatless Monday. So that's about the reduction we really should be having. But if somebody has 2/3 of their meals in a day without animal source foods, that's actually about the right direction in which we need to move. In fact, myself, I usually try to aim for not more than 2 servings of animal-sourced foods per day. So at breakfast, I may have some yogurt along with my whole grains and nuts and fruit and have lunch without any animal source foods, and then have a modest amount of, say, fish or perhaps some poultry for dinner. And so that's really easy to do, I find. And that, if we could do that more broadly, that would make a huge difference.
We're examining the impact of our food system on the worsening conditions of climate change. You're listening to Humankind. I'm David Freudberg. For more information about this segment, The Diet-Climate Connection, and to obtain audio downloads or CDs, please visit humanmedia.org. You can also download our free booklet, The Climate-Friendly Food Guide, lots of useful information on this topic. It's all at humanmedia.org. Frances Moore LePay, author of Diet for a Small Planet.
Part of the fun, part of the pleasure in a plant-centered diet is the incredible variety of, you know, what you can put together. And also it opens you to cuisines of the world that are not so meat-centered, whether it's Indian cooking with the wonderful legumes and curries, or the beans and rices and Mexican food with the salsa. I mean, I think the joy of it is really breaking free from the meat-centered diet. It opens up your imagination and your interest, or at least it did mine, and the different cultures that have never been meat-centered, and therefore they have these rich traditions of how do you make dinner with plant foods. And so for me, that was really super fun to look into.
There are far more edible vegetables than there are edible animals.
That's certainly true.
So the variety is
abundant.
Yeah,
that's one of the things I've stressed over the years. Hey, folks, you know, this is really boring just having a pork chop for dinner. You know, we ate a lot of them when I was growing up. And the freedom as a cook, you know, that you're free to experiment more because you have all these different possibilities. And think of, oh, wow, look at all the things in the store that you could be combining and experimenting with, and maybe just try one new thing, you know, a month or a week or whatever you're up to. But, you know, just to see what's out there that brings you new flavors and combos.
Welcome to Veggie Galaxy, restaurant in Central Square, a working-class section of Cambridge, Massachusetts. It attracts a mostly young crowd. Some customers here eliminate all red meat from their diet but may consume other meat products or fish. And some are full-fledged vegans, abstaining from all animal products. But in most cases, they're reducing the environmental footprint of what they eat.
So this is obviously a popular restaurant.
Yeah.
Just wondering why you're choosing to eat in a restaurant that is focused on vegetarianism or veganism.
Well, I guess the main reason is that the food tastes really good. but on top of that, I think that it's a very fun environment. It's a good place. I describe myself as freegan. I try and eat vegetarian, but if it's cheap or free, I'll eat anything.
And are there any particular reasons why you would favor vegetarianism?
I used to be an athlete, a competitive rock climber, and eating vegetarian is very good for competitive rock climbing because it allows you to get strength without gaining muscle mass. And so when I was actively competing, I was vegetarian.
You're no longer actively competing, but you're still indulging in vegetarian meals.
I mean, it tastes delicious.
It feels good. I feel better than I ever have, so.
Physically?
Yeah. And mentally, yeah. It mentally makes me feel good that I'm actively choosing to do something good every day.
And is it hard or easy to make vegan foods at home?
You definitely have to consciously teach yourself in the beginning, but I don't think about it anymore. I just, now that I've gotten into a groove, I What I tell people all the time is I don't try to recreate the meals that I used to have before. I now just look at food entirely differently.
And when did you make the transition to being a vegan?
I'm actually just over a year, so I'm still new, but I have no intention of going back.
Did you also have a vegetarian meal here today?
I had a vegan meal, yep.
And do you practice a vegan diet
when
yes.
you're not here?
Yes, I do.
When did you decide to do that?
It's coming up on 10 years ago now. I went vegetarian. Kind of the jumping off point for it was our family dog passed away, and it kind of had me think about our relationship with animals and how we can love certain animals and feel that we can kind of dispose of others and use others.
Love certain animals and eat others.
Exactly, yeah. So that was kind of my jumping off point for going vegetarian. And then after a couple of years of being vegetarian, I was surrounded by a few friends who were vegan, and I was eating a lot of vegan food, and I kind of thought about it more, and I was like, it doesn't really make sense to be consuming all of the other stuff while just cutting out meat specifically, so I made the jump to veganism.
So I've actually never been here before. I've been wanting to come here for a really long time, so this is my first time coming here.
Do you regard yourself as a vegetarian or a vegan?
Yes. I have not had red meat in 16 years. Definitely, there's a lot of family history health-wise. There's a high rate of ovarian cancer in my family, and so just eating cleaner and more healthy was something that I got into when I lost my aunts. But also just for sustainability, farming-wise, our practices, especially here in America, are just not sustainable. The way our animals are treated in factory farming, chickens, all in a confined space that never actually even see the light of day, just pecking each other, and that's their entire existence. That's their lifetime on this earth, which is just very sad to me. So, and then people are then putting that into their own bodies.
I think my health actually has improved because I've become a lot more conscious of it. And when you realize that there's a lot of positive benefits to not eating processed red meat or dairy, in terms of like visceral fat and pre-diabetic conditions, being aware of that really becomes front and center when you're vegan. I have to consider everything really clearly.
For decades, medical experts have urged Americans to increase our intake of vegetables, fruits, and whole grains. According to the National Institutes of Health, a veggie-friendly diet can lower blood pressure, helps people lose weight, and reduces the risk of heart disease and type 2 diabetes. What's newer for most people is the awareness of how this diet can help to mitigate the climate crisis. Dr. Walter Willett.
There are many environmental benefits of a primarily vegetarian diet. Again, not necessarily strict vegetarian. The most critical, I think, is greenhouse gas emissions, because the changes that are occurring today due to climate change, higher temperatures, the permafrost in the Arctic melting, the Greenland and Antarctic ice caps collapsing, those changes are going to be virtually irreversible. And we can't decide, oh, we did it wrong, let's come back in 50 or 100 years and do it differently.
There's no planet B.
There's no planet B or C, unfortunately. So there's an urgency to climate change that doesn't apply quite as dramatically to some of the other issues. And much of this is also related to land use. We're chopping down the Amazon, we're plowing up prairies and destroying forests around the world at a high rate. And that's a really critical factor, because we not only lose out on the carbon capturing effect of trees, such as in the Amazon, but we also, in the process of plowing up what was the Amazon and other forests, we release a lot of greenhouse gases as well. So there's sort of a double impact there from the expanding use of our land to grow crops, mostly to feed to animals in many areas.
So the carbon that is stored
in those areas and that is such a driver of climate change becomes released back into the atmosphere because of the way we're treating these forests.
We're both losing the capacity of trees to capture carbon, and we're also releasing the carbon that had been stored in the soil. The Amazon seems like a long ways away, but we have to consider that soybeans, corn, beef are all international commodities, so what we have on our dinner plate tonight has a direct effect on what goes on in the Amazon. If I have a healthy plant-based choice for dinner, that's actually helping preserve a tree in the Amazon.
And paying attention to how our personal choices affect the planet has never been more important. Coming up, a look at young people facing climate change as their future. Also, the fascinating history of how some American eating habits became so entrenched when the diet-climate connection continues on Humankind in a moment. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review at Apple Podcasts or another podcast service. It goes a long way in helping people find the Humankind series. And you can follow us on Instagram or Facebook, or check out our YouTube channel for full episodes of the podcast. Again, the title is Humankind on Public Radio. Finally, if you'd like to support this podcast, please go to humankindpodcast.org and choose how you can help at the top of our homepage. That's humankindpodcast.org. Thanks.